State's Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All the witnesses before this court are drawn near and will be heard. I bless the United States and this honor. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. I'm Chief Judge Allen, and to my right is Judge Bartley, and to my left is Judge Sholin. And we're convened today, probably for the first time ever on a Friday afternoon, to hear arguments in the matter of James Rudisill versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 16-4134E. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Timothy McHugh of Troutman Pepper Locke for Mr. Rudisill. I'm joined by my co-counsel, David DePippo of Dominion Energy, and my partner, Mary Grace Metcalf of Troutman Pepper Locke.
You.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ken Walsh for the Secretary, and with me at counsel table is Melissa Timbers.
Thank you. And it looks like you want to reserve 8 minutes, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
We all make that happen, and you can begin when you're ready, Mr.
Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court. This case well illustrates the real-world costs and consequences of ensuring agency compliance with the laws they are entrusted to administer, whether that's their own regulations, the plain language of a statutory scheme, or even clear, unequivocal orders from this court and the highest court in the nation. Under the exceptional circumstances here, there are three modes of relief available to the court under the Equal Access to Justice Act to provide Mr. Rudisill with his requested total cost of litigation. This first, under subsection B of 2412, the Common Benefit Doctrine. This is a straightforward and virtually uncontestable analysis. The three elements required under Common Benefit are met.
I stop you there because there's sort of a threshold issue here on that. In Felton versus Brown, the court held, quote, subsection B and the common benefits theory do not apply to this court. As a three-judge panel, we're bound by Felton, whether it's wrong, really wrong, or not.
Well, Your Honor, I think ordinarily the default rule is that a panel is bound by a prior panel's decision unless overturned by the en banc court or the Federal Circuit or the Supreme Court. However, there's an exception to that rule in two situations. One, where there's an intervening change in law, or even more importantly here, that original panel failed to consider controlling authority that existed at the time.
I agree with you that if something happens afterwards, it can so undermine the basis for the decision that it no longer binds. You know, the Ninth Circuit's case and in GAMI, Miller versus GAMI, that the Federal Circuit adopted for its own cases and that we recently adopted for our cases in a case called Rory. That's true. But I know you're talking about Essex from the Federal Circuit, but that was a case that existed at the time. I'm not aware of any law that says that a panel can say that an earlier panel decision was wrong, and therefore we're just not going to follow it.
Well, Your Honor, the Federal Circuit has adopted that rule in a case that I can provide you on rebuttal. But if you're looking for intervening change of authority, I would point you to Scarborough v. Principi from the Supreme Court. There, in discussing the nature of this court's authority under the Equal Access to Justice Act, as well as the EJA more broadly, the court explained that the EJA only involves modes of relief, not any sort of jurisdictional barrier to the court entering relief. But then importantly, it cited to this court's plenary authority over appeals from the Board of Veterans Appeals, to which EJA relief is just ancillary. It then cited to 2412B and 2412D, as well as this court's review statute over board decisions. That's from 2004, postdating the original basis for the court's exclusion of its or denial of its own authority under 2412B.
So, but I'm not aware, and maybe I missed it because there's a lot of paper in this case. Did you make the argument that Scarborough effectively satisfies the standard? Because I don't remember the standard or the analysis of that we adopted from Miller versus Gammey that says that a later decision has so undermined a pre-existing decision, so undermined Felton, that we are free to consider the matter anew.
Well, Your Honor, in our briefing, we did not focus on Scarborough specifically for that proposition. I think your sense is correct that we were focused on Essex Electro, which is very clearly controlling authority about the nature of any court's authority under AEGA. And there, obviously, Essex Electro determined that the Court of Federal Claims, by being included under 2412D as a court for the purposes of that subsection, had full authority under the entirety of AEGA. But I think if the court is looking for and only at this point has adopted a rule of there must be an intervening change of authority, in response to your question earlier, Your Honor, I would point to Scarborough v. Principi. I think it does provide that change that has not been addressed by this court. It's entirely consistent with Essex Electra, though. And I do think there is the second exception to the rule of a panel being bound by a prior panel's decision when, similar to the intervening authority change, there was a prior decision on the books of controlling authority that the earlier panel just didn't consider, and moreover, had it considered it, it would have changed the outcome.
If I can interject, though, in Jones, decided in 1992, subsequent to Essex Electro, it did specifically address Essex. So we're bound by that part of Jones, which Cook reaffirmed.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree there. Jones and the Karnas decisions were specifically intended to be abrogated by Congress by enacting the 1992 or 3 amendments to add this court to the Equal Access to Justice.
Well, but Cook basically says that pertained only to the analysis relating to subsection D, the language in the legislative history, and that we still required a sovereign immunity waiver to be fairly specific to apply fees onto the government.
That is a correct summary of Cook's holding, Your Honor, but I would respectfully submit that decision was wrongly decided as well. While Jones took into account pre-amendment of the AEGA to include this court, it looked at Essex Electro, and then subsequently Scarborough have never been looked at again by this court to understand whether by adding this court to 2412D, it should be accorded the same treatment as the Federal Circuit has given to the Court of Federal Claims, and how any other court having jurisdiction over the civil action has under the AEGA. That's the
critical point. Your argument is that the analysis in Cook wasn't sufficient or specific enough to address that point?
I think by not considering the plain language holding of the Federal Circuit in Essex Electro, yes, Your Honor, that was correct. I think that Jones specifically points to Essex Electro for support that if the Veterans Court was included similar to the Court of Federal Claims, or I think it was the Claims Court at the time, that would have changed the analysis. And that's exactly what Congress did. It cites Jones and Karnas in its legislative history, says we are clarifying the AEGA and adding this court to have full authority under AEGA. That's how the Federal Circuit has interpreted it. And again, the Supreme Court in Scarborough saying this court has plenary authority under both subsections. And if the court doesn't have common benefit doctrine authority under AEGA, it can't discipline the secretary's willful disobedience under the other common law exception to the American rule, or bad faith for that matter. That would hamstring this court's ability to ensure not only the realization of the AEGA's purpose and policy in plain language, but leave it with a limited tool set that there's no indication that Congress intended to restrict it to in the face of bad faith, which is not what we argue here, or willful disobedience.
Doesn't this court have inherent authority to ensure its rules and decisions are followed? We've sanctioned parties in the past. Was that done without authority?
It was not done without authority, Your Honor, but I think that when you look at the court's invocation of inherent authority, it is different than the broad authority that Congress has provided under the AEGA. The willful disobedience doctrine, as interpreted under the common law by the Supreme Court, would allow for an award of the total cost of litigation if the willful disobedience or bad faith for that matter permeates the entirety of the litigation. And that's what we are alleging exists here. The circumstances of this litigation all the way to the Supreme Court and indeed even here today in the Secretary's response brief dismiss and ignore the fact that after this court issued its precedential decision and the Secretary knew that he needed a stay of the precedential effect to not comply with it, he nevertheless did that anyway, and the agency didn't only establish a system for tracking eligible claimants and not actually awarding benefits to them. This willful disobedience was compounded by representations made in the Federal Circuit and in the Supreme Court suggesting that the Secretary was, in fact, complying with the court's order and that only a small minority of veterans would possibly benefit from it.
I can interject to that line of discussion. The Secretary, if we assume your argument is correct, the Secretary's inaction in regard to implementing the decision or issuing guidance or any of those things, how did that affect Mr. Rudisill?
Your Honor, it affected him as the litigant, the named party in the case, who successfully opposed the Secretary's request for a stay. He was the party that presented evidence to this court when the Secretary did not, the impact refusing to implement its decision would have on the class affected.
Well, this wasn't a class action. The Secretary didn't have an obligation to grant Mr. Rudisill benefits while his appeal was pending. You did ultimately move for that, and that ultimately happened. But what's the authority or what's the umbrella under which we look at actions of the agency, first of all, not prior to the litigation or during, but as during the litigation? And then secondly, for actions relating to other potential claimants' cases as opposed to the claimant that you are seeking attorney fees for representing?
Your Honor, I would circle back essentially to my prior response that Mr. Rudisill was affected by this refusal to implement the decision. He was, within the civil action that we have before us, he was the only party situated to ensure compliance with the court's order. He opposed the motion for a stay successfully and informed the Federal Circuit and this court on subsequent occasions that his precedential decision that he had won and defended had not been was not being implemented. The Secretary represented or implied the contrary. It's similar to obtaining an injunction against the government and other parties incidentally benefiting. That's a pretty settled rule of law. Here, this,
but in that analysis or analogy, the person receiving the injunctive relief is receiving relief. In your situation, Mr. Rudisill isn't getting relief until his appeal was exhausted.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, he did in the interim get relief under an injunction.
Right. But that wasn't relating to the Secretary's action or inaction in other people's situations.
That is accurate, Your Honor. But, you know, if Mr. Rudisill can't enforce willful disobedience to a court order of this magnitude, no other party would have standing to come into court and insist on compliance with Rudisill at the time. The Secretary was informed multiple times to implement the precedential effect based on the proceedings in this case. Mr. Rudisill was entitled to compliance with that case, even if he ultimately didn't receive any sort of monetary relief or award. And I'm not aware of a rule from any jurisdiction under inherent authority or willful disobedience doctrine or anything of the sort that would require anything other than faithful compliance with court orders, regardless of the impact it had directly on the litigant. And to the idea that this was not a class action, that's absolutely accurate. However, under the common benefit doctrine, that's not necessary. And it was made extremely clear throughout this litigation that well over a million individuals would be impacted from the administrative stage forward. The Secretary was well aware of that. Mr. Rudisill litigated this case in that manner, both in staffing and in his arguments to the courts across the board. And so I think the impact to other individuals outside of Mr. Rudisill was wrapped up in everything that the parties litigated. And I would, on the willful disobedience point in particular, I would note that it is different than bad faith, which is what the secretary responded to. We're not saying that the secretary had this malicious argument or was, you know, wanton or oppressive in advancing his litigation position. That involves a subjective finding of intent and other considerations that we don't think are necessary here. Some of this behavior probably does rise or potentially does rise to bad faith, but we're asking for only an award under willful disobedience. That requires only deliberateness, only that it was done for whatever reason. And here I think that's just absolutely undeniable. The fact that after the Supreme Court's decision, we see admissions from the secretary and policies and procedures rolling out that clearly do not contemplate a pre-existing BO implementation framework. There's nothing there. They're having to go back and re-adjudicate claims tied to the date of this court's decision 1 year prior to that decision, because all they were doing was tracking claimants and not actually awarding them benefits, not advancing meritorious cases, not even advancing them on the docket, but running them through the board's docket as they were required to do in docket order, holding cases like Ms. Perkins. This permeated the entire litigation. This was the secretary's, it is reasonable to infer that this was always the secretary's intent that there would be no implementation of an unfavorable decision to him until all avenues were exhausted, which if that's what he wanted, he could have gotten a stay from the federal circuit or the Supreme Court or revisited it with this court. But if the court is looking for another avenue of relief, we do think that under 2412D, that provides a mode of relief to and a total cost of litigation award. It's more complicated analysis, obviously, and there's more considerations, but it's a analysis this court is familiar with. The secretary bears the burden to explain why he is substantially justified. All he's put forward here is the idea of complexity and novelness of the arguments and that there were some interim judicial disagreement with his interpretation, but that does not carry the day. I think the court's decision en banc in Butts v. McDonald makes that very clear, that even a favorable decision from this court, if appealed and becomes unreasonable over time, the secretary's underlying interpretation, he can still be not substantially justified. But here, under the very broad totality of the circumstances test, there are multiple factors that weigh heavily in our favor and against the finding of substantial justification. Obviously, the merits, we know, came out the way it did, and you know, hindsight being 2020, the secretary's interpretation was unreasonable on the plain language of the statutory scheme when starting from the entitlement provisions.
So let me, I agree with you that there's, you know, there's case law from both, I think, the Federal Circuit and our court that talk about the importance of a decision that's ultimately based on plain language of the statute. But here, in addition to the fact that it's a case of first impression, and I would say it's a case of first impression in two sort of ways, one general, one specific. The specific is obviously this particular provision, but the specifics are, you know, there aren't a ton of cases on educational benefits, precedential cases. But, you know, 24 judges heard this case over time, and they split 13-11. And interestingly enough, the 13 were on the side of the secretary. Now, as you know, I was on the other side. And it's just because we had some weighted grading, because some of the judges that counted on the 11 were on the Supreme Court, so they counted a little bit more. But so in all four times that the case was heard, here as a panel, Federal Circuit as a panel, Federal Circuit en banc, and the Supreme Court, there was a split at every point in time. And as I joked with Judge Sholin yesterday, the only two of those 24 judges who saw any ambiguity in that statute, of course, were Judge Sholin and me. But at the end of the day, I wonder how much saying it's a plain language approach matters when you have this type of situation.
Your Honor, I think it is important here because, you know, we did originally argue our view as plain language, and that's ultimately where it came out. But whether it was plain language or ambiguous, I think this court fundamentally approached it very similar to how the Supreme Court ultimately did, which is to not start on this very narrow subset of the administrative provisions of the post 9/11 GI Bill, which is what the Secretary wanted the courts to focus on. It was to step back and ask, what does the plain language of the whole scheme require, beginning with the entitlement provisions found in 38 U.S.C. 3311 and 38 U.S.C. 3011 for the Montgomery GI Bill. And as the Supreme Court held, those provide an entitlement that the Secretary is entrusted to administer. And absent some clear qualification of that or reason to have to abandon benefits, there could be no restriction on those entitlements. I think also I struggle to conclude that the Secretary's interpretation was fundamentally, or at least across the board, adopted by any courts. I think Your Honor, Judge Bartley's dissent had a different tact than the Secretary's did, but even in the en banc court's decision in the Federal Circuit, they applied a plain language interpretation to 3322H1, which Your Honor will recall from Perkins, that was at odds with what the Secretary advanced. And H1 was a linchpin in the Rudisill litigation, not just Perkins. The Secretary interpreted H1 as both its date, effective date, and plain language as providing some basis for distinguishing how Mr. Rudisill was being treated, and that after H1's enactment, somehow that meant that someone like Mr. Rudisill could only get 48 months of benefits if they first exhausted their full Montgomery and then switched over to post 9/11 and only got 12 months of benefits, which is wildly at odds with how the entitlement provisions read and how the Supreme Court resolved the case. I think it's telling that the en banc court's decision never so much says that it's agreeing with the Secretary. That's never mentioned. Endorsement, affirmance, agreement, nothing like that about the Secretary, so much as the court was disagreeing with Mr. Rudisill's interpretation and this court's panel decision prior to that. So if we're going to count noses about which way this went by, you know, at the four different argument levels in the courts, I think that has to be, those things have to be factored in as well. That ultimately, I don't know that the courts, any court bought wholesale the basis in law that the Secretary advanced. That's probably in large part due to the fact that there was this focus on ancillary provisions and undue weight given to how H1 should be interpreted. And I see I'm running out of time at the moment. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'll...
Actually, more minutes. This is an important case. We will give you the time necessary.
Thank you.
If we accept your assertion that VA failed to implement the Rudisill decision, is that a relevant consideration also in determining substantial justification?
It is, Your Honor, because the totality of the circumstances test, which is applied to find substantial justification or not, requires consideration of not just the merits, but the reasons given throughout the litigation and the conduct. And here, those two, as well as any other appropriate circumstance or consideration. And here, I think reasons given and conduct are highly important. The Secretary to oppose expedited treatment of litigation in the Federal Circuit, and we presented argument and evidence that the BO was not being implemented, responded that it was being implemented across the agency, leading to the Federal Circuit declining to expedite the case and inviting Mr. Rudisill to self-expedite by filing his response brief early. That basis, we believe, what's reasonable to infer at least, is what helped inform the rest of the litigation, that the Department of Justice would not have made that representation there and then in the Supreme Court later about the minuscule amount of folks that might benefit from this if the Secretary had not been concealing that he was implementing this administrative stay and instead was representing that actually everyone's getting their benefits, there's no need for urgency here or anything like that. I don't think that the Secretary's counsel in the higher level courts would have said those things if not having been misled. Litigation could have and would have ended, I think it's reasonable to assume, much earlier if the truth had been known. As the court may be aware, the Solicitor General's office has to approve any appeal by a federal agency to a court of appeals. That approval, which was a litigation point in the Federal Circuit, came extraordinarily late, months after the appeal was taken, and presumably only after, again, we don't know because the Secretary won't release any information or respond on these points, but presumably, or reasonably presumably, was after the Secretary made representations that the case was being, the precedential effect was being implemented, and this was just a, you know, abstract issue of law that needed to be litigated. I don't think that the Solicitor General's Office of the United States would authorize an appeal after a stay had been denied, not seek an appeal in the Federal Circuit if one was still needed, and then let the agency litigate all the way up to the Supreme Court with those types of realities actually known. So when you look at, it's intertwined, but the reasons given and the conduct heavily informed the court's substantial justification analysis. And I think
were you going to continue to answer Judge Sholin?
I was going to shift gears to reasons given specifically.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say you started earlier on with the factors that were in your favor here as far as substantial justification. And so you went to merits and then you were kind of got a little bit sidetracked, reasons given and conduct. So can you continue on with your list about factors that are in the appellant's favor?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I do think it's the merits, as we discussed previously, but the reasons given and conduct are an intertwined analysis on some level. The position of the United States under the EJA encompasses all of the activity in the civil action, not just the merits arguments or not. So on reasons given, that changed over time. It evolved over time into, you know, just something that it looks very different than what the board decided and versus what was advanced in the Supreme Court. And I think it's reasonable to infer that the reasons for that is that this court concluded that it would be a legal nullity to bar applicants just based on the fact that they signed a form. That was a heavy focus of the Secretary in front of this court, and it's remained in play at the higher level courts, but it just was not front and center. So I think the Secretary over time knew that there was less and less ground for the position to possibly be affirmed on the interpretation. Likewise, in the background while this case was proceeding, executive deference doctrines were being whittled down. We had West Virginia v. EPA decided, Chevron deference eventually went away, and we see the Secretary stepping back from any sort of regulatory interpretation or anything of that nature, and instead focusing more and more on the plain language and the fact that this form was signed. I think it's important that, and I see I'm running out of time again.
No, keep answering. Okay. Judge Bartley's question.
I think it's important that one of the reasons given for opposing cert in the Supreme Court was that our estimate of the impacts to this case more broadly were overinflated. And then that subsequently the Secretary in front of the Supreme Court, when pressed by, I believe it was Chief Justice Roberts specifically on how many individuals are impacted by Mr. Rudisill's interpretation, they said it was only 30,000. And then months later, it's revealed that it's exactly what we had always argued, that it's well over a million. I think all these reasons given are intertwined with the conduct and the misrepresentations or misstatements that the court should consider.
Does the number of veterans affected make conduct more willful or less willful? Like, wouldn't just one veteran being affected be sufficient?
I do think it would be sufficient, Your Honor, but it informs the willfulness consideration. You know, so many of these facts translate across all of the modes of relief that we've advanced here. I see my time is not running, actually.
Keep going.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm fine with that. I'll take a look.
It should have been running, but that's okay.
Okay. But it's relevant to willfulness. Yes. I mean, we'll stay up and talk all day. It's relevant to the willfulness consideration, certainly. I think that it's, again, reasonable to infer from what we have presented and what we're aware of and what's before the court that there was a concerted, intentional effort to not implement the decision, to undersell its import and who it would even impact, let alone how many, that infected and permeated countless decisions made throughout the case and informed our response to that position, that very unreasonable position. The Secretary had to represent with the Solicitor General's authorization that to get en banc reconsideration that this was a case of exceptional importance. So on one hand, there wasn't a split in circuit authority. It was just about exceptional importance. So on one hand, they're saying that, and then separately saying this really only impacts effectively a handful of people in the benefits world. It's these two things, this dichotomy is highly problematic. I think the secretary used this as a litigation tactic to discourage the courts from reaching our interpretation and certainly to try to discourage the Supreme Court from granting cert where there was, again, not a circuit split. It was just a question of exceptional importance.
Okay, so I wanted you to go on with the factors that I think we had listed. So that's it for you? You're done with substantial justification. I was asking you to list things and talk about things that are included in your view of the totality of the circumstances here. So that's...
I think our three primary factors are merits, conduct, and reasons given, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes. The court... has no other questions, so
I can't tell if Judge Bartley might have a question. No?
No.
Okay. So thank you, Mr.
Thank you,
we'll
Honor.
Give you your full rebuttal time.
Thank you.
And Mr. Walsh, you can take additional time if you need it. He appears optimistic on a Friday afternoon, shaking his head. So.
Or he's ready to hit the traffic.
Chief Judge Allen, Judge Bartley, Judge Schoen, may it please the court. The court is required to consider the totality of the circumstances, and it cannot rely on one factor, but the weight given to each factor is not necessarily identical. In this case, has a showstopper of a factor. My opponent is asking the court to tell two Supreme Court justices, 10 Federal Circuit judges, and Judge Bartley, not to mention the Solicitor General and the Department of Justice, that their judgment, which aligns more or less with VA's, was unreasonable. The court should not adopt this view. The court should reject my opponent's application because the government was substantially justified for three reasons. First, VA's interpretation of the statute at both the administrative and litigation stages was based on a reasonable, albeit incorrect, interpretation of the statutory language. And EJIA is not meant to chill reasonable defenses of government positions, especially in an area where there has been little guidance. The resolution of the language at issue in this case was difficult and a close call. With no contrary authority or legislative history, reasonable minds can and still do, perhaps, differ about what it means, but the Supreme Court has decided finally how it must be implemented, and the Secretary will endeavor and continue to endeavor to follow the law. And three, while the merits went my opponent's way, jurists, including two Supreme Court justices, essentially endorsed the Secretary's view of the statute, which drove VA's actions at the administrative stage and the government's litigation position.
Mr. Walsh, can I just stop you there? So you just said that the Supreme Court's view aligned with your view.
I'm sorry, I meant the dissent, Your Honor. The two justices of the Supreme Court who dissented.
Okay. At any rate, and then you use another term to phrase it that way, as though judges agreed with your position, but your opposing counsel was just pointing out that the judges overall who voted against or held against the appellant did not actually agree with the Secretary's position. They did so based on their own analysis. Can you just respond to that?
I'm glad to, Your Honor. I'd say a couple of things. First of all, the case morphed in part because of what the courts were asking. For example, when the case went en banc at the Federal Circuit gave the parties specific questions that the Federal Circuit was interested in. Secretary didn't change his position, Department of Justice didn't change their position, but they responded. And there were alternate arguments, just as my opponent alluded, they had alternate arguments. Anyone who's usually anyone who's going to argue a case about statutory interpretation will probably have an alternate argument, even more so when there's a regulation. Regulation doesn't really come into play in this case. Is that helpful, Your Honor?
Yes. So they actually agreed with you, but you, of course, were different facets of your position were at issue before different courts.
I would say if there were changes of course, any alleged offense of that regard would be venial in nature. I do want to address my opponent's allegation that the scope of what the court should consider at this stage includes actions by the secretary during the litigation stage that were not part of the litigation strategy. The statute itself in 28 U.S.C. 2412d1b talks about the record made in the civil action. And then courts have interpreted that in conjunction with 2412d2d, which talks about the position of the United States means, in addition to the position taken by the United States in the civil action, the action or failure to act by the agency upon which the civil action is based. So we're not looking at action by the agency during the litigation phase. So there's two buckets here. There's one ultimate answer about whether the secretary is substantially justified, Your Honors, but there are two separate buckets. And to read otherwise would be to expand beyond the law that governs these cases. Now,
I love analogies and metaphors, but the bucket metaphor missed me.
What's in the bucket?
Yes, but I'm so can we try that one again?
Bucket analogy, Your Honor, is probably not great. So let me try a different analogy. We have two files that the court can open the drawers to. Almost buckets. Sorry,
I'm with you now.
Okay, the first file is full of information that documents what the agency did up until the board's decision. Okay, so that's going to be agency action. So that's the first prong of substantial justification.
Then you substantially justified at the administrative stage. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's what I mean. The second drawer would be litigation, and it would be litigation positions and litigation actions taken, as opposed to what may be going on by the people who put together the files in the first drawer, but that drawer is now closed.
So what about this? So I follow this now. So what about this then in drawer number two? Is there a stopping point there? So here's what I mean. I'm not asking you to agree with this, okay? But let's just assume that what happened, and again, this is just an assumption to get me sort of on the legal
frame. I understand.
Assume that after we issue our decision in what was then BO, the secretary asks us to stay the precedential effect of the decision. We say no. At that point, there's a meeting at VA at which VA says, listen, we're not going to try with these courts anymore, so we're not going to ask the Federal Circuit to stay the decision. And we're going to keep track of all the people who've got rudisal claims, but we're not going to give any of them any money because there are millions of these and we'll never get it back. And so we're going to hunker down. We're going to keep our heads down. We're going to say we know who these people are and things are proceeding, but in reality, VA said, we're going to slow play this and we're not going to give this out. Would that have, and again, I'm not saying that's what happened, right? But I'm saying if that were the case, is it your position that as a matter of law, that doesn't fit in either of the buckets that we consider for substantial justification because it's not at the administrative phase, And it's really not at the litigation phase because the litigation was done in a sense that you already had a decision that then you were then appealing, or how would it play in?
Your Honor, I think that would be a harder question for the Secretary, and I think you're correct. It doesn't fit into either bucket precisely. I think you could envision a scenario where it would be much harder for the Secretary to argue, where let's say the Secretary's litigators were party to something along those lines, as opposed to the agency acting in its own capacity. That being the case, in that hypothetical, I'm not prepared to say that gets you out of the drawer, but I think that would be a harder case for the Secretary to answer.
And so why, again, just playing devil's advocate here, do we know whether at any point in time between our decision in BO and the Supreme Court's decision in Rudisill, did the agency award a benefit that complied with BO to anybody other than Mr. Rudisill?
Let me ask my co-counsel for a second with your leave, Your Honor. See if she has any knowledge. I do not. I couldn't tell you. I don't know.
So assume with me that the fact was that in the period from the time we decided BO, and I think it was 2018, maybe, could have been 2019, a long time ago, and when the Supreme Court issued its decision in Rudisill, nobody was awarded benefits that complied with Rudisill other than Mr. Rudisill. What would we do with that fact, if anything?
So, Your Honor, it depends on what the cause of that was. If we're going by the original tenet of your hypothetical that the agency had a sinister plan to, you know, not comply with the court's order, you know, at some point, if the court found bad faith in a future, you know, for example, my opponent alluded, even though he doesn't have a class action in any of these cases, he has other clients who are here arguing, trying to move the ball kind of on this topic. If he could prove that there was this extraordinary action, and I, by the way, reject the idea that B comes into play. So 2412B is out of bounds. Jones does a fantastic job of giving the history of how Essex Electro kind of got to where it was and why Article I courts are generally given specific grants of EJO authority. And I think that carries over. But that's neither here nor there. This court certainly had, if this court saw that its authority was, that the Secretary was acting in contempt, of course it has its own inherent contempt powers. It's used them. The Secretary is well aware of them. But that's not the case in this instance.
So, and I'm with you on that, right? And in fact, I know your friend on the other side brought up the Perkins case. And although, you know, I wrote the Perkins case, so I think that Rudisill fit that, but it didn't fit the actual factual pattern of Mr. Rudisill. So that might be different. But there are people out there who fit the actual factual pattern of Mr. Rudisill, right? There's a period of service that then ends. It's not continuous. There's another period of break. And I get what you're saying, that if we thought that the agency wasn't in following the decision, we could issue a contempt sanction. But what I'm trying to get at is, in your view, under subsection D of the statute, if it were the case that the agency awarded nobody a benefit consistent with Rudisill/BO, in circumstances in which the factual periods of service, even though Perkins later says that's not what's going on, but you could read it at the time, would that have any implication in the EJA analysis?
I don't believe it would, Your Honor. Again, I think it's more tempting, right? The facts kind of almost, you know, where you see that kind of hypothetical injustice, I understand I would be tempted to look there. But I do think looking at the case law, the way that the courts have talked about the two phases, the agency phase, the administrative phase, and the litigation phase, I don't think it fits in. And let me give you another example of or an analogy. Most litigation that's covered by cases outside of this court or outside of cases that were appealed from this court to the federal circuit involve an agency and they involve DOJ. We essentially stand in the shoes of DOJ. We're not quite unique because some of the independent commissions have their own counsel, but for VA, it has a statutory charge where our office is almost unique in that we appear at this level. So usually what you have is you have the agency and then you have DOJ is on the hook for all of the litigation. We're really not different. And so think of those cases where DOJ is handling all the litigation, unless it goes up to the Solicitor General. In those cases, no one's looking at what the agency is doing. I'm not aware of case law. Now, the possible area where you could see some case law that could, I think, potentially cause confusion or mislead the court would be kind of the Motorola cases where courts retain jurisdiction and where action continues and that EJIA isn't decided until the action is completed, unlike this court, where the court certainly has jurisdiction over EJIA, but cedes jurisdiction on the merits as soon as mandate is issued. I don't know if that's helpful or not.
Well, sort of, but it's not your fault that it isn't, right? Because it's just this doesn't normally come up, right? In the sense that this case had an enormous history. I mean, it had a long timeline. And so the longer the timeline, the more possibility to have actual or perceived shenanigans going on, right? And you're right. This also highlights the fact that there are a number of things that come from the fact that your office represents the government before our court, and then you hand the baton over. And so those types of things do matter. But, you know, the atmospherics here are just weird. And they may not play into EJIA. That's what is the difficult legal issue. Another example, it does seem that depending on the moment of litigation, the importance of this case shifted from the world is ending to no big deal, right? Because the briefing, and again, you were not doing it. It was the Department of Justice. But the briefing to seek en banc review at the Federal Circuit was, this is the worst thing. It's going to be disastrous. And then in opposition to cert, no big deal. And again, that may not have an implication here. And that's what I'm struggling with. And you're helping me.
So let me address a premise that my opponent put forth with which I disagree. He suggests that there is, if not bad faith, either intent or something along those lines. This is an area where, you know, the agency has limited resources. Most of the we understand when the court says we need an answer on something or what have you, we do our best as an agency to marshal those forces. But program offices that attempt to answer the court's questions, a lot of times they're knee-deep in trying to provide benefits to veterans. And they don't always have the data that they think they have, or they don't always have the data in a timeline, and they may think they have the data in a timeline. I don't know enough about the specifics of what was provided when to the Solicitor General or what have you. I do think if my opponent's suggesting that we misled the Solicitor General, I don't think that would fall into the EJIA analysis at all, because that's the government and the government. But in any event, I resist vigorously the idea that VBA was trying to mislead. It was, if anything, it was we learned more facts along the way because this is something that was not anticipated. And the other thing I would say is to change the program. It seems like, for us as lawyers, And I have the same reaction when I hear about what's going on at the agency. For us as lawyers, it seems like it's simple, but it's a big program, and there's a lot of people. And everything is quasi-automated now. So it's not like we could say, hey, you know, we have a clerk who can go adjudicate a claim, you know, at the drop of a hat, if that makes
well,
if that
but
makes
if sense. I can ask a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Went to our court's decision. It looked like there was guidance in issued by VA telling the regional processing offices to, I think that's what RPO stands for, to keep working under the pre-BO decision guidelines. So why would you, as an agency, even if you can't change things to make the correct decision, why would you keep telling your offices to keep making wrong decisions?
Your Honor, let me give you two answers to that question. The first is, I don't know enough about the underlying facts. I think there were a number of communications. I don't know that the court has seen any complete record. They've seen what my opponent has put forward. I don't have a good enough.
It's on its very face in November 2019. There were probably some other ones. So multiple times, guidance went out to the field saying, keep on keeping on.
And Your Honor, the second part of my answer would be, I don't think it's within the scope of this matter, the CEJA matter. I understand that it may fit my opponent's theory, which is why I certainly endeavored to answer your question without
troubling.
On its face, if you told me that the bottom line, and we had a record that was prepared that had all the evidence, like we had notice and we could marshal what was accurate and what have you, and the bottom line said VA is attempting to resist a court order without a good reason and without permission, I would say that on its face, yes, that is troubling. That is not something that, that's not something that I would ever advocate or want to be part of.
So if we had a veteran whose case was pending while Mr. Rudisill's appeal was before the Supreme Court, or I guess that wouldn't have been the right time, prior to the Federal Circuit's decision in the en banc court, let's say, and they weren't getting a decision, or they could they have filed a writ of mandamus with this kind of evidence, and the court could have then found for them and potentially sanctioned the secretary?
Your Honor, I think a writ would have made sense, and that's where the action would have properly lay. The flip side is the secretary may very well have, you know, having been given notice and about the nature of the proceeding and given advance notice, Secretary's program office may have something to add to the record. I don't know. So I wouldn't walk away based on this proceeding thinking, you know, necessarily VA did something that's out of bounds. I also would.
So that to follow. So that's why I set up the first hypothetical the way I did to make the evil government, right? Because that's the hardest situation.
Sure.
As opposed to sort of the metaphorical fog of war confusion situation, okay? And so I'm not aware of cases that have actually had to deal with that question, whether something that is, that's, we'll call it deeply troubling, because you've said that would be, if that were the case.
If the hypothetical were true.
Right? But just because something is deeply troubling, and this is what I'm wrestling with in my mind, is whether or not it factors into the EJA, right? Because I agree with you in the abstract, at least, that it is a little bit of round peg square hole, right? Because it's hard to see how that, the evil machinations idea that I've done, says anything about the substantial justification for the position. Because you could imagine a government agency being evil, like I said, even if they thought they had a really good position. meaning that, right? In other words, they could just have guessed wrong about whether their position was good. And so that I just wanted to explain, that's why I set up the evil hypothetical situation, because that's the that really sets this up as to how, if at all, if that type of thing existed, it plays in.
So, again, I take you back to the statute, and I'd ask you to look at, you know, maybe cases that have looked at the statute. I'm looking particularly at 2412D2D, and it talks about the action or failure to act by the agency upon which the civil action is based. And to me, that kind of suggests a temporal limitation, a categorical limitation. It doesn't talk about ongoing actions by the agency. And that would be inconsistent with the record that would be for the court in an EJA proceeding, which shouldn't, right? This shouldn't be a second litigation. It shouldn't be a second litigation about the merits. And so I would say because of the record and because of the suggestion in the statute, or maybe the mandate in the statute, that I think this is probably out of bounds for EJA, particularly with the understanding that this court is limited to remedies under subsection D.
And would you briefly discuss the appellant's argument about whether or not Scarborough undermined the court's holding in those other cases?
Your Honor, having just heard it today for the first time, I will endeavor to do my best, but I would ask that the court, you know, if the court is inclined to explore that further, Secretary would like an opportunity to submit papers on it. Although I know there have been way too many papers in this case so far, and I'm sorry to ask that of you. My understanding, the strongest part, listening to him and having some familiarity with Scarborough, although I did not look at it in this context, is the idea that there's some intrinsic power that comes to the court. But Scarborough never was asked this question, to the best of my knowledge. I don't believe, and with the limitation that I've already conceded to you about my knowledge, I don't believe that was an issue before the court. And you can look at a number of courts, including this court, more so in memorandum decisions. But this court, when judges aren't focused on the question, will sometimes throw in B as part of the authority. They've never done a remedy under B, to the best of my knowledge. I don't believe any of the judges of this court have done that. So I would say it's probably, unless there's really something there that was addressed, or that this intrinsic power comment is that broad, it would fly in the face of certainly my understanding of how the Article I courts in particular have been judged to have various EJA powers.
And our adoption of the Miller versus Gammy rule in Rory would have to say that the Scarborough decision was completely irreconcilable with the other one.
Right? Yes.
Now, what about the other argument? I just want to, and I know you addressed this somewhat in your papers, but the argument that essentially our cases about B and A were at the moment of their birth so horribly wrong under Essex that there is some exception for that.
I certainly don't agree with my opponent on that point. This court in Jones did an excellent job, as I alluded to, discussing the kind of the history of the Article I courts, and you know, Essex preceded it. And so really the question in Essex was, and maybe this is not quite as narrow as Scarborough, but the question in Essex was, the Court of Claims had turned, let me make sure I get the nomenclature right. It went from the Court of Claims to the Claims Court. So it had been an Article III court, and then it was changed to an Article I court, the name changed. And so there was a question as to, and so that was in the FCIA of, I believe, 1982. And then there was some question whether the new Article I court had EJIA power because there were doubts about Article I courts that hadn't been specifically empowered to consider EJIA. And so what you saw predominantly in that case was the idea that yes, you did have power. Now, did they talk about B? Yes, they talked about B. They talked about it specifically in terms of the claims court. Jones was this case saying, was this court saying, we don't have EJIA power at all. But then in the successor cases that we've talked about with Felton and Cook, the court held clearly with the idea that they'd considered Essex, right? And so the only potential spoiler here, which I don't think is a spoiler, is Scarborough, but that's because I haven't had a chance to consider that point, if that's helpful.
No, that was helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Your Honors, I did want to talk very briefly about some of the reasonableness contentions. There's no justification for an elevated rate because subsection B is not available, and the common benefit theory is not available. My opponent indicated...
You don't have to rush. We're going to give you the extra time, so we'll bump it up by the 10 minutes.
My opponent indicated earlier, and this, you know, gets to the, you know, did the secretary act badly? I'm still not conceding the secretary acted badly, but he says stare associates stands for the proposition that there could be an elevated rate to punish egregious conduct. That was true in the Court of Federal Claims or the Court of Claims version, but the Federal Circuit version specifically said that was not the case. They overturned the Court of Claims. They said instead of an elevated rate, the EJIA already contemplates the idea that if you had to do more work because your opponent did something, maybe you get more hours, but you do not get an elevated rate on that basis. And I think that's probably, unless the court has additional questions about reasonableness, I think we probably stand on our papers. Your Honors, I'm sorry. Judge Bartley, I don't want to make the mistake of not addressing the factors that we see in this case. In addition to, I think I stated them in the introduction, but I did want to make sure that the court understood that we do take the Butts test seriously. And some of the things that Butts looked at in particular were the reasons given inconsistency. In Butts, it found that it favored the government, but it didn't resolve the question. The court did. Here, there is no contrary precedent or hints from earlier concurrences. So in some ways, Butts suggested that, there was something going in the secretary's favor. There was a case from this court, but the topic had been covered, this unlike the educational topics. And so there were hints out there that the court basically said the secretary should have taken. In this case, there were no hints. There was nothing for the secretary. So that should cut the secretary's way. As far as reasons given inconsistency with VA policy, his reading of the statute and its logic is essentially captured in Justice Thomas's dissent, and I think it's consistent through. And so while we ultimately lost, there's no question there. There wasn't a policy issue. There was certainly no contrary policy. And I think unless the court's willing to say Justice Thomas's dissent was unreasonable, there was logic to the secretary's position. Your Honor, you acknowledged earlier that certainly Patrick and Butts suggest that it's harder in statutory interpretation cases. I think this is an easier case than those. One, there is no contrary legislative history. And two, the Supreme Court, unlike the more typical scenarios, was forced to coordinate. I know coordinate's a dangerous word, coordinate multiple statutes and to make them work together. And the language is certainly subject to competing interpretations, competing canons of construction, and it's undoubtedly complicated, as the dissent said, and I think a fair reading of the majority opinion did. The other thing I would like to say before I sit down is we know that there is language in the majority opinion that could be construed as unhelpful to the Secretary's position.
Majority at the Supreme Court?
The majority at the Supreme Court. And so the use of the nonsensical is not in service of Justice Jackson's textual analysis, but was based on the majority's conclusion that Congress, as a policy matter, would not have wanted to impose an exhaust or forfeit requirement. But that really didn't go to language. That went to policy. And Justice Thomas, I think, gave, even if you don't agree with it, gave a contrary, adequate reason why that policy preference might not have been Congress's. Congress sometimes is worried about the public fisc, and sometimes it limits the amount of money that goes out accordingly. I'd also say, if you read through the end of that same paragraph in the majority opinion, the majority uses very different language. The tone changes, and I think if you want to look at language, they say the more sensible view. Not the sensible view, the more sensible view. So that would be commonly understood to mean that there are two sensible views, but one is better, or at least potentially two sensible. And then the view that the statutory text best supports, again, suggests a contest between two reasonable views that are both supported, but one is more persuasive to the majority in that court, which wouldn't render it unreasonable. And I would also say in Klein, this court recognized that words used on the merits may have a different import. And so the example that the majority used in Klein, or the panel used in Klein, was that there might be a court case that uses unreasonable in the merits, but that wouldn't necessarily have an impact on the substantial justification.
And just before, on your list of factors, you may have covered this without using the actual word, but what, in your view, is the, if any, the import of the fact that there was the M22 provision that described, as I understand it, that basically what the board did?
I think,
is there a relevance to that?
I think that potentially cuts in favor of the Secretary for substantial justification. In fact, I think it does cut in favor of the Secretary, and I have it here, and I glissed right over it, Your Honor. So I thank you very much for it.
The reason is Judge Schoen and I, years ago, although frankly neither one of us remembered being on this case, a case called Lacey, in which a factor that was important in that case turned out to be the absence of any regulatory guidance.
Yes, Your Honor.
I just wanted to get your position on that here.
Yes, Your Honor. In that case, the court noted even in cases of first impression, it has to be reasonable, and that if it's wholly unsupported by the plain language or legislative history, it's a problem, and then looked at the failure to provide guidance in that case. And here we do have guidance. The guidance is consistent with how the Secretary and essentially how the Supreme Court dissent viewed the statute, and therefore it should cut in favor of the Secretary. And if there are no further questions, we'd ask the court to deny the application, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Mr. McHugh, we'll give you the full 8 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. There's a few key points that I'd like to respond to. First, there was significant discussion, obviously, about the scope of the record for EJIA purposes. And I have two overarching responses to that. First, under D, which is the only provision of EJIA that imposes the record limitation that my friend was referring to, is satisfied here by looking at the the record as it existed in the litigation, where we attached to briefs in the Federal Circuit, or one brief in particular, our merits brief for the panel, one of the policy documents that reveals the administrative stay. The issue of a stay and the impact on other veterans was raised before this court, and the numbers of impacted veterans were discussed throughout, and it mattered significantly on the record as it exists without any supplementation by us or any of the Secretary's documents that we now have and only have recently obtained for the most part without even looking at those. You can look at the record as it existed throughout the litigation and conclude that record speaks to the Secretary's conduct and reasons given as contrasted to the merits. Separately, though, I think this potential, you know, concern that the Secretary has highlights why Congress did not include a record limitation provision or any other limitation other than the common law standards under B, and why this court is a court that has authority under B to reach beyond what was just before the agents or the courts and what the government's substantial justification for its position was. D creates an entirely new standard for attorney's fees, as explained by Congress in the public law enacting the provisions, the EJA, and in the legislative history. It was to create, ultimately, a lesser standard than the common law exceptions to the American rule for pretty egregious situations or exceptional victories, but yet still give the Secretary or any agency, for that matter, a defense based on substantial justification that would be limited to the record as it exists in litigation. So if this court is confined to only what was precisely filed in the case, where there's no discovery and there's no opportunity for us to put anything into the record that wasn't already in front of the agency, it's impossible. How could we get evidence into the record of noncompliance with a precedential decision of this court if we're confined to what the record on appeal is, essentially? Separately, I think the Secretary, my friend across the aisle, identified some different factors under totality of the circumstances than were ultimately raised in his brief. His response brief focuses on complexity and the lack of any prior judicial precedent on this interpretation. So I would encourage the court to limit itself to the points that were raised in the response brief. The Secretary bears the burden of showing substantial justification, and it's simply not met here. I would also, I know some questions about Scarborough came up and whether that truly is a controlling change in law. Subsection B was front and center in Scarborough.
So taking the position you just took with respect to the Secretary's justification point, why should we not say that you forfeited the argument about Scarborough undercutting Felton Jones, et cetera, because you didn't make the argument in the briefs?
Your Honor, I would respond in a couple ways. First, the substantial justification is a defense of the Secretary that he bears the burden for under EJA. We have to plead it. I think Scarborough even says this. That's the only, substantial justification is the only pleading requirement under EJA. Otherwise, everything else is just part of an application as it needs to be presented. Secretary then bears the burden once we make the allegation of showing substantial justification. The Scarborough issue is a question of law that the court can reach, whether presented in the briefing or not. I raised Scarborough in particular in response to Your Honor's question standing here today, because I do think it's relevant to whether this court has properly applied controlling authority over time. And in the interest of justice, at minimum, I think the court needs to address that. But we think it is encompassed within our briefing. By raising Essex Electro and pointing out that there was controlling authority that existed that the court has not applied in any prior precedential decision, I think that fairly encompasses also whether the Supreme Court has touched on this. But looking at the face of Scarborough itself, and I would encourage the court to also listen to the oral argument in Scarborough, the court frames the question as those two ways. First, in the background section, it discusses the reforms that the EJA provided, that it amended what it had previously authorized courts to award costs under 2412. That was prior to EJA, only costs were potentially available. and that the EJIA added two new prescriptions to Section 2412, including both, first, 2412B made the United States liable for attorney's fees and expenses, quote, to the same extent that any other party would be liable under the common law or under the terms of any statute which specifically provides for such an award, end quote. That was a quote of the statute. Then in application, the Supreme Court, at page 413, says that they clarify what the precise question in front of the court was, which is about the timing of an EJIA application under D, which obviously would be the type of application that would be in front of the court from this court at that time, but then immediately goes on to say that none of this has anything to do with the court's jurisdiction or authority to grant relief. Instead, it concerns a mode of relief, costs including legal fees, ancillary to the judgment of a court that has plenary, quote, jurisdiction of a civil action, end quote, in which the fee application is made, see 2412B and D1A, and then cites in parallel 38 U.S.C. section 7252, giving this court plenary authority over the board's decisions. I quote all that and read it into the record because I think there's no way to look at Scarborough without concluding that the courts, just like in the Rudisil itself, the court starts this analysis from first principles about what does the statute, what did Congress intend to do in the statute, and then applies it to a very specific factual pattern in that was before it. So I think it's important for the court to take up the issue of whether it has subsection B authority, not only this case, but you know, to consider the implications of what it could mean for other cases across the board.
Could I, before, and don't worry if you go over time, because, but I debated about asking you this question, but I feel like I have to, because it's, there are lots of steps in this analysis, so we might not never get to my question here, but so in the billing, right, there's a lot of billing entries, but the ones that I wanted to ask you about were the argument before the Supreme Court. I'm going to butcher your partner's name.
Misha Salen.
What he said. So he argued the case. But in addition to him, your bill includes time entries for seven other lawyers who actually traveled to Washington. And although they say in their most of them say in their time description that they participated in oral argument. I imagine they sat in the audience, right? I don't think anybody took over the podium from your partner. And then somebody else billed for listening to the argument, who wasn't there, who was listening remotely. It has been a very, very long time since I have been a billing lawyer at a large law firm. But I did spend 10 years at a large law firm and billed. The rule under EJIA is that you wouldn't bill to, you know, John and Jane taxpayer what you wouldn't pay bill to Acme company, right? Is it your practice to actually bill for that number of lawyers to simply attend a court proceeding?
Your Honor, I'm happy to answer this question and any other specific questions the court has about the billing practices and the bill that was submitted for review. This is an exceptional case. I personally have not worked on a case of such exceptional impact and exceptional government recalcitrance that it would, other than this one, that would require that level of staffing.
It's not the work that they did beforehand. And it's also not the fact that they got to go and actually bill their time, right? As I always used to tell people when I was a law professor, if you're ever at a big law firm and a lawyer says, do this, but don't bill your time, that is a giant red flag, right? Because it's that lawyer's, the billing lawyer's responsibility to say, no, you worked really hard on this. It's a Supreme Court case, or it's a summary judgment in a little tiny town in Massachusetts. Go and observe. Bill your time. But then the lawyer exercises billing judgment to say, I'm going to write it off. Because I have trouble believing that the world has changed enough that if this were Acme company that you were representing and billing them, that you would have actually billed for seven people to go
and one other person to listen online and expect that client is gonna pay. And the reason is this is only like 15, 20 hours out of our $1.9 million bill, sure. Right? But what I look for in these EJIA cases in the reasonableness realm is what I call the canary in the coal mine. Is there something that just jumps off the page? You know, often it's somebody who, and I haven't looked at your bill, so this is not about that, but in much smaller cases, somebody who's got 1,000 entries of 0.1, 0.1, 0.1, 0.1, right? It suggests they're billing that file a lot. And so I just had to say that this was sort of troubling to me. As much as the government and the maybe not giving any benefits to people is troubling, this also was troubling because I'm having trouble believing that or understanding how you would actually bill a private client for this.
Your Honor, my response to that is that if Acme Corporation retained us in a case like this that affected their permit to build something and the federal agency that authorized that or issued that permit engaged in the type of, frankly, egregious misconduct and misrepresentation here, misstatement. I hesitate to attribute any misrepresentation to anyone, but I think the statements were not true when made. I can say that much. We would staff it in that way, and I think that company would expect significant attention be paid to argument in front of the highest court in the nation, including because what has subsequently happened here is what we were concerned with, that the secretary would still not implement the case correctly, and there would need to be more litigation on behalf the class of affected veterans. And I think when viewed in that way, it is extremely reasonable to have that level of attendance. There were four attorneys total at counsel table, including Mr. Saitlin, which corresponded neatly to what the government had at the Supreme Court. The rest of the folks attending were folks that had visited or rather traveled to DC to help with the argument prep itself in the final stages, not all of which is captured in the bill because we exercise billing judgment there to discount any time. I mean, we had something like 700 hours that we wrote off or 600, nearly 700 hours, 18% of the actual time spent on this matter that was captured, and putting aside the inevitable time that just wasn't captured. So I personally elected to put the time down for actual attendance and observation of the Supreme Court's decision for frankly, what has inevitably come after, which is follow-on enforcement litigation, ensuring that the secretary is held to account for what has transpired here. And on that point, I would note that I would expect an agency, the federal government, that had a response to these types of allegations that it could make, it would have made standing here today at minimum. But it is telling and deeply troubling that all we heard was, I don't have, with respect to my friend across the aisle, that I don't have that information or I can't engage with that hypothetical today or things of that nature. This is not a hypothetical. This happened, and I think the court can draw fair inferences from the evidence that's before it and the fact that this has transpired or taken place for as long as it has and the hundreds of thousands of individuals who deserve their benefits now maybe retroactively will get them when it's potentially far too late for that to matter to them. They've already gone to school. They were being given negative decisions under law that this court said was not applicable and not informed of their appellate rights correctly or that there might be this different decision out there that could affect things. And it's a somewhat of a hollow victory for those folks to potentially, in their 40s or 50s, have benefits they might be able to potentially use. You know, their debt that they incurred for school is not being paid off. Their children who have deferred going to school or been hit with retroactive reimbursement requests or things of that nature, like they're not getting the relief that would have been avoided. The secretary just did what this court ordered it to do. He raised similar administrative inconvenience concerns that were not as well fleshed out as here, but were presented in the stay motion, and this court rejected that out of hand. So I do find it hard to believe that the secretary's counsel could have the full knowledge of what the agency was doing and make the representations that they did in court. I'm not attributing anything negative to attorneys for the secretary. I don't think they would do that. I think the secretary, however, and the agency engaged in this willful disobedience that's perfectly within the scope of this court's review.
Thank you, Mr. McHugh.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And we want to thank Marty for the argument in this case. We went over, but that was equal to the size of the record in the case, let's put it that way. And we're going to come down and greet counsel, but for right now, the case is submitted.
All rise.